anomaly. Something that deviates from what is standard, normal or expected. An oddity, peculiarity, irregularity, inconsistency, incongruity, a rarity.
I have been a nerd since long before I could have heard that bookish girls should look and act a certain way. And I'll still be a geek when I am utterly antique, because I do not care what normal people say.
Hi, this is Sue. This week I've got another one of my DragonCon panels for you, also from 2013, called Does a Contract Negate Non-Consent? That's a wordy title, but the panel is from the Whedon Universe track and discusses the world of Dollhouse. Even though this is more about the world that the show takes place in than the show itself, I'll sound the spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't watched both seasons. Also, this panel gets into ethics, the philosophy of law, the question of personhood, as well as topics like coercion, consent, bodily autonomy, abuse, and even rape. So if you're uncomfortable listening to discussions of those topics, you might want to skip this one. This is a live panel recording of a panel that was kind of audience-driven in a room close to a major road, so there is some ambient noise. Unfortunately, it happens. Since we on the panel introduce ourselves, I won't do that now, but if you're a big podcast listener, you might recognize at least one other familiar voice. And at the end of the panel, it'll just lead right into our normal end credits. Personally, I can say this is one of my favorite panels I've ever been a part of at DragonCon, and I was fascinated by it all over again when I re-listened to it the other day. So I hope you enjoy it too.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll go ahead and get started. I think it's about 1 minute early, but this could turn into a discussion-y panel, and so we might need that extra minute. My name is Colby Calvert. I'm with the Whedon Track, and I am the moderator of this panel, which is Does a Contract Negate Non-Consent? If for any reason any of you don't know what we're basing this panel around, it's about Dollhouse and the idea of them contracting away X number of years of their lives and ethics and contracts and some melange of topics. So I'm going to let the other panelists introduce themselves, and then I think they've got a plan for where we're going to go. We're going to be off and running, and I think, are we going to be doing questions and things after we get some talky-talky out of the way first?
Always do, yeah.
Great.
No, ladies first, actually.
Okay.
All right. I'm Tracy Mahaffey. I'm a philosopher and professor at Florida State University, where my academic research focuses on the philosophy of action, which includes free will, questions of agency, autonomy, and then ethics and feminist theory. I'm a contributing author to the Blackwell Philosophy and Popular Culture series. I won't mention which book in this crowd, and then additionally I write about sort of feminist themes and philosophical issues in science fiction and fantasy sort of literature.
I'm nowhere near as fancy. My name is Suka Smother. I am a podcaster. I'm on the staff of the Anomaly podcast, and we talk about just about anything and everything that we feel like, really.
My name is Kevin Batchelder. I'm a podcaster. My main podcast is called Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV, where we cover lots of genre shows. But I've been a big Whedonite for years, working on the Signal podcast for Firefly, and also a couple of Dollhouse podcasts over the years, the Dollhouse podcast and Active Architecture, talking about Dollhouse quite a bit. So it's I love all the Whedon shows, but Dollhouse certainly gets me going, so that's why I'm very much looking forward to our discussion.
I will just add to that, because I forgot to mention at the beginning, my other function here is that I'm the resident lawyer. Sorry. I'm licensed in Ohio and Kentucky, and a lot of this is going to revolve around stuff. It's going to be more broad legal concepts, so there will not probably be any specific answers to anything in case you have specific legal questions, etc. So that's what I'm doing here, and guys, take it away.
All right, where do we begin with this one? Tracy, maybe you can kind of start, if you would, some definitions or some thoughts on really the core of what we're talking about here.
Sure. So, the panel topic, of course, is this question of whether or not contracts can negate consent. And in thinking about this, for me, what comes to mind is this question of whether, if I sign a contract now, does that, you know, negate the need to get my consent for something later? And there are a lot of questions that go into the consent questions, so we could think about this from a kind of philosophical perspective. I'm sorry if this starts to get boring, please don't throw things at me. So from kind of a philosophical perspective, consent requires a couple of things. One is that you have to be competent, and a competency is oftentimes a fairly straightforward legal concept. I mean, courts can determine whether or not someone is competent. From a philosophical sort of perspective, competency requires that you have a certain level of rational deliberation at your command, that you can weigh reasons, that you can evaluate the reasons to do things, make decisions. You also have to be free, in a sense, not free in the sort of ultimate free will sense for consent, but you do have to be free in the sense that you are neither compelled nor coerced to do the things that you do. And I think that's actually a really interesting question in the concept of the dollhouse universe, whether or not in signing the contracts in the beginning, whether there's any sort of coercive or compelling element to that. So you've got to be competent. You've got to be free in the sense that your actions are voluntary, that you're not compelled and you're not coerced. You also have to have a certain amount of information, right? So you hear a lot of talk about informed consent, especially in things like bioethics. And in order to make decisions, you can't be deceived about the basic, or make decisions sort of freely consent. You can't be deceived about the basic aspects of the things that you're consenting to. You have to have enough information, not all the information available, but enough information to make a sort of reasoned decision. So for me, the big three things then are going to be competency, voluntariness, and what was the third one? Oh yeah, it's going to be competency, voluntariness, and then information, that you're informed. And then from there, we can talk more about some of the other aspects that might undermine consent for the agents or the actives in the dollhouse at various times. So, does that help? Okay.
One thing we want to be very careful of, and I'll throw it out right up front because this is the way I kind of roll. We're not trying to bore you. Now, the concept is interesting to me, but one of the key things when it comes to talking about Joss shows, I think, at definitely Dollhouse, is the rabbit holes go very deep in this series. So we do want to make this an interactive session. So as we're talking about a topic, we don't have to hold questions till the end. I think we definitely have more fun when we're going on things. So if any of us bring up a topic and you folks have a thought on it, raise a hand. We'll try to get to you. That was fast, yes.
I just was wondering while you're talking, what's the difference between being compelled to do something and being coerced?
Oh, okay, great. I'll try to make this really fast in case it's boring for other people. But you're coerced when you're sort of forced, right? So if someone comes out on the street and points a gun at you and says your wallet or your life or something like that, that's coercion, right? But compulsion can be internal. So someone who has, like, OCD, for example, might be compelled to turn a doorknob 5 times before they open or close a door, right?
Someone whose life is falling apart might be compelled to go
right
to the dollhouse.
Well, so there's an interesting question right here. That's exactly that. So the dollhouse, of course, targets, maybe target's the wrong word, but the people who are become dolls, who become active, are sort of identified on the grounds, target's a little too normative, so are identified on the grounds that they kind of have nothing to lose, right? And so there's a sort of either coercive or compelling nature to it, I think, and the fact that you get money, right, for it makes it also at least potentially coercive. So, yeah.
Over this side, sir.
Just really quickly,
sure.
those three things you were talking about,
yeah,
in terms of making contracts valid.
Well, no, I'm sorry. That wasn't for contracts to be valid. That was for for consent to be sort of true consent in a philosophical sense.
Okay.
So I'm not a lawyer. So I don't know anything about making contracts valid, other than
just from kind of a philosophy of law perspective, but that's
okay.
It. Yeah.
Never mind that.
Okay, sorry, I just wanted to make sure that I clarified that.
Yes, right there.
Couldn't you argue that we are compelled when we choose to do anything?
Yes. That's the short answer. Next question. Actually, I mean, you could. So agency and free will is something that I work a lot on, and you can argue that you're compelled by external forces, that the laws of nature together with the history of the world makes it so there's one and only one possible future, and what you do is sort of being pushed along this line. And you're sort of always compelled.
I meant it in a more, like basically, like if I sell my house,
right,
because I want to buy a different house, well, I have this compulsion to buy a different house, whether it's because I need more bedrooms or I don't like my neighborhood or whatever, I have made a decision. And so when I sign that legal contract, I'm doing that because of a decision I made.
Maybe. I think what I want to say is that for me that's not compulsion.
Okay.
That compulsion entails an almost sort of irresistible force. It can be resisted, right? Compulsion can be resisted, but it's very, very difficult to do so. And so for me, if you're we have lots of reasons for selling houses and signing contracts and doing various things. I mean, I go to work, and one of the reasons I go to work is because I really like to have my paycheck, and I'd really like to be able to pay my bills. And but I'm not compelled to do that, right? I mean, I've sort of, it is voluntary in a sense. So if I were sort of forced in other ways, either sort of internally through psychological kind of processes or through a need for money to pay for, to bail someone out of jail or something like that, right? I mean, I might have external things that are kind of pushing me towards that. I think that we make decisions, you know, we sometimes change our minds. You know, some decisions we're more firm about than others. Might there be compulsion in some of those things? There might be, but I think you have to flesh that out a little bit more. And so there's going to be some gray area, but I think that this is one of the things that makes the Dollhouse such a great way of talking about this particular concept, and it's because it's unclear whether or not the agents, and I say agent from a kind of philosophical perspective, but the actives in the show are their actions are voluntary when they sign, if they're compelled or coerced. Just because you're in a bad situation doesn't mean that you are not free when you make a choice. And if any of the actives sort of have the requirements of agency in the show, as it goes through, it's Echo. And then the sort of complexity of her kind of knowledge and character really, I think, lends an extra kind of layer to that. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I think I talked long enough. That
yes.
So this, at least to me, seems to have a lot of overlap in concept, at least, with, you know, kink and BDSM and that sort of negotiation of boundaries and consent and the whole how do you consent and what counts and all of that. And I wondered if you guys might talk about that a little bit, see if you see overlap. I mean, if you can talk about that.
Well, I think that's a little bit in how I approach this topic, and that was from the angle of bodily autonomy, which, if you're not familiar with the term, is the concept that you have control over who or what uses your body and for how long, which is why you can't be forced to donate blood or tissues even after you're dead. That's because of your bodily autonomy. And consent in within this concept is something that has to be continuous. And when Dollhouse or when the actives' personhood, when their reality and what is essentially makes them is removed from their body, that ability to make that consent continuous sort of is taken away because they're being stored. They don't really know what's going on. So it becomes a question of who has the right to give consent for that physical being. And if there's no personality in there, does Echo like the personhood of Echo, who is in the active when Caroline is not there, have the wherewithal to give consent at all.
Well, one thing that I think is very fascinating to me, it's in some of the notes we had right here, a little related to where we're going, but we're kind of going around the same idea here, is these people, as we saw a few times in the series, when they actually, you know, literally signed on the dotted line. You know, we were sitting there at the table, we had, you know, Adele's little teapot, and she's, you know, telling them it'll be all okay after each of them is, you know, on the hook for murder or something else. So they're very much... they do have free will, but they're certainly not thinking they do when they're sitting there with the offer that's on the table in front of them. Do they have... is there any way for them to truly know what they're about to get into? You know, that's what it really comes down to, it, to me, in looking at this. I mean, I get a chuckle. We see nowadays all the commercials you see on TV for drugs. Possible side effects. Death. And pretty people running around in flowers.
Did they make your eyelashes go?
Yeah. But no, the idea is, was there anywhere in that paperwork, not that we ever saw it in the show, or a little video you might have had to watch before you signed, this idea that, yes, you might be, you know, basically a prostitute, you might be putting your life at risk, you might be supporting some neo-Nazi group that you would never do in real life. So how much, how well informed were you before you got a chance to make this decision? And the contract end of it a little bit, not to put you on the spot, Colby, is how much really should have been or legally needs to be spelled out ahead of time.
Well,
in a general sense, I'm trying to put you on the spot.
In a general sense, informed consent, you know, I think you nailed it pretty well. It tracks pretty well with the legal concept of informed consent. It's just that you have enough information to make a informed decision. I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory what informed consent is. I did think, when you asked could they ever know, I had a couple of thoughts about this, and not just lawyer thoughts, but regular people thoughts too, that there's a couple of things about that. Is there's the assumption that I think they had to know, because I think if you're signing over blacking out for a number of years and you're giving your body to someone, I think you have to assume anything that you could imagine is going to happen to you. I think that if you like think, oh, they definitely won't, you know, pour me out, then
I'll be working at the local church for 7 years.
It's not a reasonable assumption.
Okay.
That's my thought. But I don't know what to say about the contractual informed consent. That was pretty much same thing.
Yeah, actually, the sort of reasonable assumption thing is interesting, because from the legal perspective, right, that's the question, right, that you ask, right? Would a reasonable person expect that this kind of thing would come out? So it doesn't, you know, well, whether you expected it is kind of beside the point. Whether would a reasonable person expect that this action would lead to this kind of outcome?
Right. And any reasonable person in that world would be expected that it's basically sex for hire.
Right, but I wonder if they would imagine that they would be like, like assassins and various other things. I mean, you know, I mean, maybe they should have imagined, but it is an interesting.
That's what I always thought. I mean, yeah. I just have to see them sitting there with the teapot again. Who would want to ask though? If you're in that box, would you really want to know? I don't think I would. I'd probably just take the long sleep for the big bucks on the other side.
Right. And given the way we read, like, EULAs and things, like, we, you know, sign contracts and stuff, it seems like, okay, I need you to sign here, and I need an initial here, and here you're initialing that we might do any number of things with your body while you're in this state.
Not limited to.
Well, and the other thing is that obviously the whole concept of the show is not on the up and up. So they can have somebody sign a contract that says whatever, and if they get caught, they have to deal with that. But I mean, they don't have to make the contract sound, because who cares? They're not abiding by the law anyway.
And unless I'm mistaken, most of like the waivers that you sign really don't mean anything. It's just that people think they do, so they don't sue if they get hurt.
Yeah, you can waive away your rights, but you have to know exactly what you're waving away, and it has to be pretty clear. There are ways out of most waivers.
Yes, over here.
Yeah. I think, to me, one of the interesting things about the contracts is the idea of saying, I don't want to be able to change my mind. I think the state I'm in now, I'm in a better position to make a decision, so don't let me change my mind. You know, and to me, that reminds me a lot of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where people are signing over to have their memories erased, and they say, no matter what I say, you know, as I go through this, this is the way I want to do it. Do you guys know if there's anything in the real world that parallels to that, where people are saying, listen to me now and don't let me?
Power of attorney. Yeah. I would assume that they signed a power of attorney with the contract. Power of attorneys are generally not revocable. You have to sign a revocable power of attorney. Otherwise, once you sign it, then it's you're giving that power to somebody. So I don't know a lot about power of attorney. It's just from what little legal knowledge I have of it. That's, and I just thought about that while we were sitting here, is I guarantee they haven't signed power of attorneys.
Yes, sir. Again.
Oh, I was going to say, you were like, what happens in the real world is like that, and joining the military is kind of like that. Once you join the military, you're like, I want now to be, in the next however many years, unable to leave this place and be forced to do whatever you want. Well, like I say, I don't know the legal part.
Well, I think it's based more upon police power, like the power that's granted to the government rather than power that's established by a contract. So that's just more because they say they can.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is there anything in the real world that allows to deal with this whole continuous consent idea? Like, for example, I'm married. That doesn't mean I have to have sex tonight, even though I signed a contract.
Actually, you're right. So actually, I have something to say about that. And until fairly recently in our own history, we didn't have a sort of concept of marital rape. And it was actually 1993 when the last marital rape laws were taken off the books. And I want to say it was in North Carolina, but the last laws that said that there can't be rape within marriage were taken off the books. Or the statutes. I don't know. Are they the same thing? We should talk about that later. I teach business philosophy, so we actually talk about this a lot. But and the thought was this, right? And actually, this is not an unusual position for people to take. But the thought is that when you get married, that there is a sort of blanket consent that's given, and that it works both ways. So we're talking about heterosexual marriage right now, but a husband can demand sex from his wife at any time, and she has to consent, or he just already has her consent, and a wife same from her husband. Now, we don't really ever see much about that, but because of that, right, if you were married and you were raped by your spouse, you had no legal recourse. There was nothing. There were no laws that even that could even imagine that this could take place. And it seems very, very odd to us now, right, that we would ever
unless
have
there
that.
Was what they would classically consider domestic violence.
Right. Yeah, but even for a while, like the sort of concept of domestic violence didn't exist, right? I mean, if someone hit their spouse, particularly if a man hit his wife, then it was. It wasn't necessarily illegal. You should probably not provoke him. Some of you might have heard Patrick Stewart's recent talk that's been going around about his mom and her experiences with domestic violence and his experiences growing up and things, and telling her, Mrs. Stewart, you shouldn't provoke him. I mean, like, that was the kind of response. And luckily, there is not a state now, and has not been a state for the last 20 years, where there is no recognition of rape in marriage. But before 1993, there were states where getting married was blanket consent, and that seems clearly wrong, right? I mean, it just seems clearly wrong that if you're in a relationship with someone that you don't have to do that. I'll say one more thing, and that's I'm probably getting in trouble for this, but anyway. Florida State University has a thing they've been doing. They've been trying to educate particularly men on campus about sexual assault and not to commit it. And there's a program called FSU Men Measure Up, and you can Google it and look up the statistics. But they asked they asked men on campus how important they thought it was to get consent before having sex. And something like 80% of men at FSU said they thought it was important to get consent before they had sex, which was really disturbing, because what about the other 20%? But the reason I say this is because I wonder if the question was formed badly, because if you're in a long-term relationship with someone, you don't say to that person, hey, honey, is it okay if we have sex? or maybe you do, right? But there is this sort of idea of a kind of ongoing consent, and that the consent is there unless you kind of revoke it. And it's not sort of, it's not a contract, right? But in the real world, we kind of function this way. That you have my consent unless I say no. And you don't have to ask me every time to say yes. So I think that there is at least a very normal, everyday kind of way of thinking about this idea that you could make an agreement and that the consent continues. And, you know, this idea of sort of bodily autonomy, right? So unless I say no, right, unless I say my safe word, if we're talking about something like in B&D and S&M or something like that, then you're okay to keep going.
Yes, sir, I think you can.
I was going to say, it sounds like it hinges around the idea of what rights are sort of fundamental. Like, bodily autonomy is clearly a very fundamental right. And a lot of the rights that the active sign over seem to be very fundamental. But for example, if I sign a contract to write a book within a year, and I can't just say, well, I don't consent to the contract anymore, I'll get sued for breach of contract. So it seems like there are some rights you can waive away, but there are more fundamental rights, and it comes down to a question, I guess, of either philosophically or legally, what rights can't be signed away no matter what, and what rights can you sign a contract and say, well, okay, now you can just do whatever.
I reserve the right to be completely wrong about this. I know there's going to be some lawyer standing in the back, and I'm going to get halfway through what I'm about to say, and go, you're wrong! Theoretically, I think you can sign away anything that your little heart desires or anything that the person who drafted the paper wants you to sign away. The problem is that a contract that is illegal or violates public policy will usually be either voided automatically or void in full, depending on the state. But to answer the question in short, I think in theory, you can sign away whatever you want.
Philosophically, it depends on what you mean by rights, but John Stuart Mill argued that basically the only thing you can't give away is your agency. So you can't voluntarily become a slave, you can't sort of turn over your agency. And that's a question. I mean, it's a short-term thing, it's not forever, and for Mill, the foreverness was a part of the problem, but it does depend on that.
As long as it's a limited time.
It's like indentured servitude almost, more than any kind of slavery, I guess.
Right, yeah.
All right, I'm gonna skip the line. I think I know this guy, and I know he's a lawyer, and I know he's gonna yell at me. So I just want to see what he is.
No, you're right. I was just thinking along those lines. Part of the issue with the fundamental right or whatever is that usually the remedy for a breach of a contract is money. So, like, if you don't write that book in a year, you just have to pay someone money. No one forces you to write that book, and that's kind of what's different here. Is you don't have any way out of it. If you breach it, they're not gonna take money from you. I mean, you're compelled to do this, and that's what makes.
You could sue for specific performance, but court would be crazy.
Your agency is completely removed. Yeah, right. There's no way to deviate from
it. You can't. It's not like a runaway slave situation.
So far we've been talking a lot about the legal principles of, you know, agency and consent. And in my head, I keep going back to some of the more philosophical issues. So, you know, you had made the point earlier how, like, even after you die, you cannot, you know, you still have to give permission for what happens after you die to your body. And, you know, you hear about some of the things like with Henrietta Lacks, you know, people whose tissues have been used within medical progress. And there's always kind of like this, you know, where is my identity? Like, where is the I? You know, it's not in my tissue. If I cut off my hand, I'm still me. And so, you know, where is that line? And, you know, you think about agency. Well, in the sense of the dollhouse, while we are, our agency has been taken away, but also in the sense of the show, our complete consciousness is no longer present in that body. And in the concept of the show, somebody else's consciousness is inserted into that body. So is that body still yours? Or does it belong to who's in there now? Like, there is that scene where Dr. Saunders says, I don't want to die, you know?
Yeah. So, and there's the question, too, of the personalities they put into that body. If you do consider them people, fully formed people, okay, but they're still programmed. So they're programmed to give consent. Is that actually consent?
Right. Okay, I feel like I've been talking too much, but about the personhood thing. So this is actually something that really both bothers me and intrigues me about Dollhouse, and that's the question of who the agents or the actors are in this show. There are a lot of different views about personhood, and one of the most sort of popular ones has to do with this idea of psychological continuity. So it isn't just that your memories make you who you are. I mean, there are lots of things that happened to me when I was little that I don't really remember, but I hear lots of stories about them, and so I think I remember them. I've got sort of seeming remembrances and that kind of stuff. I've got false memories. I've got all kinds of stuff. But there's a sort of psychological continuity. There's a story that I can tell about me as a person, and it explains, like, you know, sort of who I am and how I developed and all those things. And if I came in tomorrow and my personality was completely different and I had a different skill set and all those things, like, that would be a clue to people that something was not right, that there had been sort of a break in that psychological continuity. And that is exactly what happens in the Dollhouse, right? The actives, when their memories and personalities are stored, right? They're taken out of them and stored separately. They become sort of these blank dolls, right? These sort of blank people walking around, and I'm not sure at all that they're the same persons who signed the contract. I mean, physically, obviously, the same body, but bodily identity is not personal identity. And I'd be happy to talk about that another time, maybe. But bodily identity is not personal identity from a philosophical perspective, and I think probably the case that the actives are different people than the people who originally had the bodies. Now we've got a problem with, like, body sharing. And I think that the example that you just gave is the perfect one. You know, here we've got somebody who's in the body and says, no, don't take me out because I don't want to die. So they've got self-awareness. They've got agency, right? When they have a program in them, it's just not the original person. And so if it's not the original person who signed the contract, then the whole idea of, like, sort of continuing consent says, well, look, it's not even the same person who signed the contract. So if my sister signs the contract, I'm not responsible for it. So there you go.
Can I jump in there? Because something just occurred to me while we were sitting on this panel. Has anybody seen the Breaking Bad Star Trek plot that was going around a few weeks back? Nobody watches Breaking Bad. Okay, well, now I'm going to talk about something. Star Trek. Anybody like Star Trek? So there's this theory that I just got tipped off to recently. Maybe people have heard of it, where the transporter actually kills you every time you step in it.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So as far as I just thought of this, I think there's a very good argument to be made that even when you put those people back in their bodies,
they're not the same person.
They die
when you
took them out.
Sure.
So then it's murder, and then that's a different law.
Right. Well, yeah. So that's why the contract wasn't valid to begin with. It's because by taking them out, you basically killed that person. So,
but another thing too that I come back to, a lot of these things when we're talking about contract to write a book or whatever we're going to say, as from the time you start that contract, you have points all throughout it, virtually every minute, to back out or request a change. If you become an active. But they don't check in with you every 6 months to say you still want to stay in there. You've lost any chance the moment they take you. So, I mean, have you lost? That seems like you've lost a lot of basic rights at that point. Even
I zoned out for a second. I was still thinking about the transporter.
Maybe you just went through the transporter. No, the idea. I mean, if once you become a doll, you have no chance to back out of this.
Right.
There's no check in every 6 months like a checkup to say, how's it going, pal? You want to stay in there anymore?
Well, and even if there was, then I think you get into the issue of you have to go back through informed consent again, and then you would have to lay out every single thing that you did.
Here's what you did the last 6 months, by the way.
And then you get everybody going, oh, no.
Yeah. And they're certainly not going to check in with them before each mission. Hey, we're about to send you out to be an assassin or maybe
thumbs
a super
up,
spy.
Down.
Is that okay with you?
And then it's just an employee.
Or, you know, somebody.
It doesn't work so well. Yes, ma'am.
Could an argument be made that when they're in the doll state that they're not even a person, if there's no consciousness?
I think the dolls have consciousness. I mean, it depends on what you mean by consciousness, but I mean, I think they satisfy that requirement. They just, they're aware of their surroundings. They experience, the world around them, that kind of thing. So there's a sort of consciousness in the sense of
awareness.
But if
it's entirely artificial, where's the line?
$100,000 question.
I mean, you just like wait even your great grandmother laying unconscious in a hospital.
if they're putting a super spy into a doll, they're programming that doll. So, is it somebody who can make a decision, or are they just following their program?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So is that what you mean by it's artificial? Because they can't make any. They can't reject anything that they're asked to do. Or it's like time for a treatment, and they go, okay, let's go. I really like the treatment right now. Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's part of the programming, right? But even people who are brainwashed, right? I mean, they don't lose their. They don't lose their consciousness, right? They become sort of conditioned to do certain things and to respond in certain ways and things like that. So, I mean, I think potentially you've got like so many different people sharing the same body, right? Because the blank doll is somewhere between a non-person and a person, I think, right? They've got consciousness.
Yes, she's had her hand up for a while, I think.
Going back to, different personalities equate different people. You do have instances in the real world where a person starts developing a brain tumor and they go from a very sweet, very religious person to this horrible cusser who's going out strip dancing every night. You have people who develop strokes that, go to bed speaking German and wake up speaking French. You have complete personality switches when the wiring in the brain gets messed up. But in the real world, we still consider them the same person. They're still held to their same contracts. They undergo therapy. The only current form of deciding whether or not anything passed is whether or not they no longer meet the intelligence level of their prior adulthood. If they no longer can meet a consensual adult intelligence, then their prior contracts are voided and they are given, to a caretaker, whether it be state or family or something. If we're arguing that different personalities entered in create a different person each time, in the real world, we consider the body, not the personality, to be the person.
Right. Bodily identity is certainly very important in the actual world. It's the world I live in. My bodily identity is also very important to me. But bodily identity isn't everything. We could do the sort of, thought experiment thing where it's like, look, if I lost my hand and it's replaced by a robotic hand, am I still me? How much of me can I lose and retain me? If it were possible to download my consciousness into a positronic brain, would that still be me? All of my memories, all of my experiences, even if my body were fully mechanical, right, at this point. There's no longer any sort of original part of me. All the parts of my body that exist now did not exist when I was born. My cells are constantly replacing each other. I mean, all those things are happening, right? There's all kinds of stuff that goes on with bodily identity that sort of bothers us, right, about these things. So you're right that when people have strokes or they get amnesia, we still hold them responsible in some ways for the things that they decided to do before that. But there's that very famous case of the guy who in, I want to say it was Virginia, developed a brain tumor, then molested his stepdaughter, was convicted, and at his sentencing hearing complained of a headache. They took him to, a really bad headache. They took him to the emergency room. Turned out he had a brain tumor that was stimulating the pleasure center of his brain. They removed the brain tumor and all of the associated behaviors and desires that had to do with him molesting his 12-year-old stepdaughter went away. And that, I mean, when things like that happen, there was a Law and Order like story that like that they did that was based on this, right? But when things like that happen, those we consider to be like mitigating. We don't hold people responsible for things that they do because a brain tumor is, you know, putting pressure on a part of their brain that like that then they can't sort of control their behaviors, right? And so there's this idea of that's going along with this of responsibility. If I sign a contract, like in the dollhouse, and then I go and I let them drop my, you know, take away my personality, and I kill people, or I'm a prostitute, or I do other things, am I morally responsible for the things that I do in that state? I mean, that's, I mean, one of the ways, or am I legally responsible? I'm certainly causally responsible for it, right? My body did it. But am I responsible either in a legal sense or in a moral sense? And when people go through things like that, when they have these, either they have a psychotic break or they've got a tumor or they've got something else that causes really weird behavior, we oftentimes say that they're not, because we say that they're not themselves. And it's not that they're not themselves fully, but if we could imagine completely erasing all the stuff that makes you you and replacing it with somebody else's them, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that seems to me to be, you know, what we've got going on. So, it's not that, you know, we don't get cases in the real world where people have very big shifts. It's just that they're, they're a little bit... I guess they're a little bit different, so I don't know. I hope that makes sense.
Yes?
Just wanted to loop back real quick to something that the Wonder Woman up here had said about removing the personality and the memories from somebody. Does that really take the person who they are away? I would say that Echo, and even to a certain extent, Sierra, Victor, and Alpha all demonstrated that that's not the case. You remove that away, they still had pieces of who they were with them. So especially with Victor and Sierra, they were still in love with each other when they no longer knew who they were. Echo, anomaly or not, still had, she didn't know that she was Caroline, but she didn't remember being Caroline, but she knew she was Caroline. She still had that activist, like, something's going wrong, I need to fix this kind of thing. So I think she was still her in that state, she just didn't remember she was her. On a separate point, we had mentioned before about when you take their personality and things like that away, that's kind of like committing murder. I think Millie / November / Madeline / everything else she was kind of shows that that is the case, because when Paul Ballard, you know, signed on to the dollhouse and said, you know, my price is to give Millie her life back, make her Madeline again. Madeline, when she came back, something was broken. She felt it. Like, even after everything was in there, she didn't remember doing anything that she had done. She had no recollection other than just her interaction with Paul, which was very brief, that she had done things that she wouldn't normally be okay with. But she felt that she knew something wasn't right. The entire Madeline that was taken out was not put back in, and she knew it.
Well, one thing I always thought on that angle, which is an excellent one, is, was that because somehow the process, you know, the Berniak Topher missed something, so therefore that was a flaw in creating actives?
Topher doesn't miss anything.
And I'm sure he would say that if he was here. But, no, is that the core of the big question of defining where that is? Meaning you can't totally take someone out. Or could that be argued that, oh, we're only at version 1.0 of creating actives, and by the next 2.0, that's not possible to happen? That's very much that moving line of defining the human being, to me. So it's an excellent example of where it's not in the show's mythos. That's why it proves that you really can't, in my mind, because of that always stayed behind. Same way with the episode when Echo was the mother, became the pregnant, you know, the bodily reactions and so forth. You know, it proved some of those lines very much couldn't be easily cut. I got a few, yes.
If someone signs power of attorney and also consents to this sort of crazy stuff, then becomes, let's say, essentially the same as in a patient who has severe Alzheimer's, which is what those dolls in the dollhouse really look like, you know, people walking around without much comprehension of anything, couldn't the person who's holding the power of attorney be held liable for allowing bad things happen to them?
I mean, if you sign over, you know, if your mother, grandmother signs over power of attorney to you and you put them out on the street.
Well, but I mean, like, but suppose that that person already signed something saying they were okay with whatever you wanted to do to them. And then gave you power of attorney, and then you did horrible things to them.
These are squishy concepts. A lot of them do squishy very well, and we don't pass any laws in this country anymore, let alone hypothetical ones, so there's no laws about this.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to it, like in one of the very first episodes we heard Cooper, you know, where Echo's telling him, you know, so what, you just wipe our brain, and he's like a computer, and he goes, yeah, that's exactly what it is. It really comes down to how we're treating humanity in itself. Because in a lot of those episodes, they literally are, you know, the actives, when they don't have a personality, are just like a computer without an operating system. You can boot them up, they'll do some very basic things, and that's it.
Or at least that's the goal of what they want.
Yeah. And then you load in an operating system, and now you're Windows, now you're a Mac, now you're Linux, whatever.
Blue screen.
And then sometimes, before your computer profile, you're able to look in there and see, oh, well, so-and-so's logged in now, but I can still see some of this other profile, but I don't have access to it. Or, oh, they left their pictures, I can get to their pictures. You know, so there's some of that same stuff going in, so as far as the whole... Is it still you? Is it still... It's still the same computer. You know what I mean? So it's still the same device, the same piece of hardware. But then it's how... Are we viewing the hardware, the person, as being something that's capable of making decisions? Or are we viewing this whole spiritual viewpoint of... I don't know. I kind of got lost halfway through there.
That is a discussion about Dollhouse. Got lots of hands. I'd point to bring up, but I'll wait. Yes.
It's actually interesting that what he's saying about the, you know, what Topher was saying about, you know, wiping out their personalities like wiping out a computer. From a computer programming standpoint, when you do that, unless you go through some incredibly, you know, strong processes to do so, you don't ever truly wipe a computer. You can erase things off the hard drive. Somebody knows what they're doing can always recover that information back off of that hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it still goes back to what I was saying before. When you erase their hard drive and put something else on that hard drive, that previous stuff is still there, just that somebody has capable of finding it. Alpha is capable of finding it. He's very good at finding it. And Echo just happened to be, you know, Forrest Gump her way into finding it inside her own hard drive.
The part of this discussion is bringing me to the concept of nature versus nurture. So maybe the part of Echo that makes her an activist is just part of her, or Echo or Caroline or that body that makes her an activist is part of her nature, is something in her DNA. Maybe that's the case for Sierra and Victor. Maybe there's something that draws them together that's not a personality thing, but it might be a programmed genetic thing.
I would also just add that it may be that Topher is amazing and makes no mistakes, and I'm okay to say that. I just want to make sure. So that's fine. But perhaps it's not Topher, right? That it's just that it's simply the hardware that you're working with. It is. It's not that his process is imperfect, but that you could not ever perfectly erase all of the bits so that none of them could ever be recovered. So, and if that's the case, then there's a problem from the very beginning, because there's a flawed premise, which is that you could take away someone's personality completely and replace it with something else, and then just give them back to them later, because there's always the possibility for error.
Yeah, I don't see anywhere in the contract where they said, you know, 200 people have come through our program and 100 are now finally integrated back into society.
Right.
Yeah. No, don't think we're seeing that. The back, sir.
Well, the idea of turning people, thinking of people as computers to be programmed, is part of the whole process, because they have to dehumanize these people in the first place in order to be able to do these kind of things to them. So they're thinking in terms of, oh yeah, we just reprogram them because they're basically just computers and they signed a contract so we can do what we want with them. They don't think of them as people anymore at all. And what you're talking about is that the people start shining through. You know, in any each iteration, some part of the person still survives.
Like a VHS tape, you can never truly erase that first recording on it. No, and that's part of it really there. I mean, part of what I wanted to touch on, because we're getting near the end of our time allotment, again, another fascinating part to me of Dollhouse is this discussion of contract and all this is fine, but let's come back to it. What if this, kind of throw a little to Kobe, You come back to the, quote, whatever the correct legal term is, the enforceability. I mean, is any of this ever going to really truly go to a court? No one, Dollhouse doesn't exist, so how could they ever really take anybody to court over any of the contracts?
They would call the cops and sue.
Yeah, but I mean, at that point, isn't it more likely to be seen of what's been going on as a crime to the point that that becomes unenforceable?
Yeah, well, and I think that as far as if you take away the criminal aspect of it and just look at it as a contract, and if they were sued over it, I think that, I mean, like I said earlier, anything that's, seems we're making circles, because anything that's illegal or against public policy is going to be voidable at the election of the complaining party, and you could also argue that they're under duress, which is a legal concept that will void a contract if you try to void it. So I think that there are a lot of ways out of these contracts if you ever were able to get there.
But it was an NSA experiment, so it's okay.
Because the other thing we really haven't touched on here, not that it's directly related to this, but I think it's a very important part of any Dollhouse conversation.
I just get my client out of this contract.
It really comes back to the ethics side. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the core of Dollhouse. Any of these things, we can talk about them being enforceable or legal or contractual, but, and this is the part I like very much with all the different characters in the show that work in the Dollhouse, is where is everybody drawing a line to say, ethically, I'm okay with what we're doing. You know, Adele sees this big flowery way of helping society. Topher just wants the tech to work. Boyd and other folks, Ballard, basically just say, it's a paycheck, I'm doing it for this. So it's interesting to watch where that keeps wavering on an episode-by-episode basis, because that's the human nature of all of us. We can say any of these, it's like you said, any of these are letter of the law or contracts, but we all know in our gut if something we can't truly get behind it, that's when we find ways out of it. Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's take some of the legality issues out of it.
Thanks.
You're not doing the assassinations and stuff. You go into the Dollhouse program. They program you to type for 5 years. You're doing nothing illegal. You're just doing transcription of perfectly legitimate stuff.
So you are working at the church.
They put you, essentially, yes. You get back out 5 years later and discover you have carpal tunnel. What are your legal recourses?
Well, I'm suing them. I'm a personal injury attorney.
However,
I'm filing that lawsuit tomorrow.
However, the contract is...
He's standing outside the Dollhouse in the cards.
Sorry, what were you saying?
But, okay, this contract you signed said they can do anything, so...
You told us we couldn't question it.
Does that mean your risk is still something you can take them to court for?
Yeah, but
or
it's
part of the risk that you have accepted?
But the other question side of that is, are they ever going to tell you that's what you were doing? How would you ever know you did it?
Well, we were discussing the imperfect process, or, oh, you came across the security footage from the monitoring room. You came up with the evidence.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
so you don't need a lawyer to help you if inactive. You need someone who's good at hacking computer systems to find the traces of what you actually did.
Well, and however you find it out, right? You find out that's what you did, and now you get carpal tunnel, and you're pretty sure that causally that's what caused it, and you know, so you want to know, what can I do? Can I see them?
But that contract you signed, does that?
You're going to lose that. I'm going to lose that lawsuit.
But I'm guessing.
Because the proximate cause of you having carpal tunnel syndrome wasn't the work that they made you do. It was you being a dumbass and signing a contract and let you type for 5 years straight without taking a break.
Unless there's some sort of clause that says they'll return your body to you undamaged.
Yeah, the original state.
I was not able to consent continuously for five years.
But something's telling me they're smart enough that they're going to have a good medical program to hide that before they let you out.
Yeah, maybe. And ethically, when you're talking to philosophers and we tell you that you weren't able to consent the whole time, but the law may not help you with that. So.
They could put in a false memory that you had carpal tunnel before you got wiped.
Just think about it, yes. Retrofitted. My head hurts. Yes.
So to circle back to kind of the philosophical definition of consent, what do you all think of the idea of looking at it as, you know, there is an element of kind of body sharing, that there's your physical person, who you are naturally or originally without any kind of, you know, human interference, and then you have the person who is in your consciousness right now, and you need consent from both parties before it's true consent. You know, are there problems with that, and could that even translate to philosophically, you know, in real life?
you know, considering a physical test and a mental test.
Yes. That was long. I was just making a joke. You guys can both go ahead. I just didn't know the answer because kind of lost the question.
I think what you're asking is is going back to this idea of sort of having different persons within the same physical body, so there's a couple problems with that. If you know that you're body sharing. Like if you know that you share a car with someone, for example, and you wanted to paint flames on the side of your car that you share with someone, it would probably be a good idea to get that person's, okay on that first, right? But if you, in this case, it's not clear who knows what about who in the body at any given time. And so you might think that you're just making a decision about your body, this body that's yours and that you inhabit. In which case there are some just logistical problems, I think. But imagine if you could imagine that you could be aware of your other persons that come in and out. So I guess you could like leave yourself a sticky note, and it would be like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, you know, hugs and kisses, echo, and then then leave the other personality a sticky note afterwards and be like, you are insane. No My Little Pony tattoos, and that would be that. But
I think the closest analogy we have to that would be Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, where, you know, is one responsible for the actions of the other?
Yes.
We used the analogy earlier of like people with tumors who have had strokes, and how that sort of alleviates them from moral responsibility from the actions.
Possibly.
Okay. I don't see that as being analogous to dolls, though, because that, for example, Caroline is absolved of responsibility for what the doll Echo does because she's not there to consent to the things that she's assigned to do. But Caroline has consented to anything you guys want to do that's cool by me, knowing that that could entail killing people or, you know, whatever. So I don't see how you could argue that Caroline is absolved of moral responsibility for the actions taken by the doll Echo when she consented to the use of her body in that manner.
Well, I'm not sure that she is. And I think that the brain tumor stroke example was one that was sort of challenging the idea of that bodily identity isn't how we identify people. And it is definitely how we identify people. Like, we see them like, hey, I know you, and sort of like everyday life. And sort of challenging my thoughts about the sort of psychological continuity stuff. So here's the difference, right, between signing the contract and saying, yeah, even if they told you everything, right? I check here, I might be an assassin, I might be a prostitute, I might be someone's dead wife, I might whatever it is, right? The difference is that in your everyday life, you can back out. I mean, this has come up several times, right? But you can back out. You can get out of the contract. As hard as it is to get out of the military, you can. It might involve some very unpleasant, experiences, but you could do that. You can always say no. But what you do when you sign the contract is you take away the ability to change your mind later. And that goes back to the question that you had earlier about, you know, are there any rights that you can't give up? And that's why, and that's one of the reasons that Mill thought that you couldn't ever voluntarily become a slave, because to become a slave truly. Do a lot of philosophers agree with it?
But not all of them.
Not all philosophers do, but I mean, I think probably most do. But Mill sort of famously put it forward and said that, here's the reason why, right? It's because basically you give over your ability to ever make any more decisions for yourself.
Right. It's the last one you make when you're signing.
And you just can't do it. We can't do it without someone erasing our personalities or whatever, but you can't do it. If you give away your agency, you are no longer a person.
The contract doesn't require them to sign a you can't back out clause. The contract I'm just saying, I've never read it, of course.
We have copies.
It requires you to go through the process. After you go through the process, you don't consider the possibility of saying, no, I want out. None of those people thought about leaving.
Well, they're taking away their ability to revoke their consent.
Thank you.
He said they didn't think about anything. I said except him.
Yeah, I think they're
Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, going back to the whole issue of sort of the ethics of it, because we keep saying a lot of things like, oh, well, they're going to whore you out or send you to assassinate people. And I think depending on what moral theory you're subscribing to, you might say that it doesn't matter what they make you do. They could make you help orphans and elderly women for 7 years in a church. Yeah. You know, but that, like Kant would say, you have to treat people as ends, not as means to an end. That it's immoral to compel people to do anything, even if you're compelling them to do something that would otherwise be considered good. So I guess that's a lot of the question is, you know, obviously they want to make the show exciting, so there's a lot of action and crime and things going on. But, you know, would it be okay even if they were making them help orphans? Like, wouldn't some people would feel that's just instinctively immoral, regardless of what they make you do?
They would be right.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the short answer. But, it doesn't matter what you're compelled to do, whether they make you into... So I don't know if any of you ever saw a show called Babylon 5.
Yes.
Babylon 5. Okay. The worst punishment that you can receive in the Babylon 5 universe is death of personality. And what they do is they take horrible criminals, people who do really really bad things like kill lots of people, and they erase their personalities and then they put in them. New values, right? They now value helping people, and they have sort of like a new identity, and then they send them out into the world to do good things, and we don't ever really follow up very much in that. So I mean, we don't know that it actually sticks, but we assume it does because that's what they do. They no longer have the death penalty.
Well, we saw that one.
This is worse. Night in Gethsemane. Yeah. Gethsemane. I can't say that word
Gethsemane.
Right now.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sue. Because I was having trouble with that one. But it doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter whether we make you Mother Teresa and send you out to help the orphans in Calcutta. It makes absolutely no difference. If we have taken away, for whatever reason, right, your ability to direct your own life, then. From almost every ethical perspective, that would be unacceptable.
We're just about out of time. One more question?
I'll make this really quick. So another real-world example. We're basically debating, you know, is Echo responsible for the contract that Carolyn signed? I mean, the entity Echo, I mean, is she forced to carry out the 5 years that Carolyn decided to sign for? In our own real world, and it's very rarely used, and you'd know more about it than I would, but multiple Maybe. Personality disorders. They've had instances where somebody does something heinous. They might even kill a person, and the multiple personality insanity plea is given. And in some cases, a person is, you know, they're not let go, they're sent to the mental institute, but it's decided that they were not responsible for the actions of their second personality. Because that's not what they would do. Would that be
miracle
to what we're talking about?
I don't know from a legal perspective, and since Coleman doesn't do criminal law stuff,
I know enough that insanity is, I mean, it depends on the state. It's
right.
Like, there are some states that are like, is it a mental disease or defect?
Right.
There are some states that are like, can you appreciate what you're doing? So it's kind of hard to...
Yeah. I mean, yeah. No, I will just say this: that one of the reasons why we allow for, I think, insanity in these cases is that if you are not in command of your mental faculties, then you can't consent. You can't. You're not making decisions. You don't even. You are the things that I said in the beginning, right? About being voluntary, your actions, about being informed, about being uncompelled and uncoerced, right? You are not able to. You're not competent, right? In these cases,
to make decisions. So as soon as the Carolyn entity is no longer able to keep up continuous consent of the contract she signed, would it be void?
I don't know. I mean. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question.
Squishy.
Fuzzy. Philosophers do squishy, but mostly in like hypothetical sorts of things. I mean, like not real world. Like on another planet, we can imagine a situation in which things are slightly different. And then I'd be happy to answer that one. But in the real world, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we would hold Caroline responsible. I think that probably we would think that she's responsible. We would think that there's good evidence that not all of her personality was erased. That Echo had the capacity to make decisions while she was in, or at least some of the time while she was in Carolyn's body, and we would punish whoever was in that body for what they did if we wanted to punish them or hold them responsible.
I think we're just about out of time, folks. Appreciate you coming. Now keep in mind, please give feedback in the app to the track directors if this is something you'd like or other topics. Feedback is what makes the con, so thank you very much for coming.
Right down to the last explosive ounce. But I'd rather indulge my many passions, even if my squaritude's a little too pronounced. Perhaps I do not strike you as a geek.
If you wish to contact the Anomaly Supplemental, you can at the email address, which is moregirlygeeks@gmail.com. That's girlygeeks with a Z at gmail.com. Or if you like hearing the sound of your own voice, like I do, you can call the voicemail line at 248-419-GEEK. Yes, it's one of those numbers that you can use alphabets on, and that's 248-419-4335. To stay up to date with Anomaly and Anomaly Supplemental news, you can follow them on Twitter at Anomaly Podcast. That's the at symbol, A-N-O-M-A-L-Y podcast. Check out the Anomaly blog for geeky articles and Anomaly Supplemental show notes. Find it online at anomalypodcast.com. That's A-N-O-M-A-L-Y podcast.com. Theme music is used by permission of Marion Call. Thank you, Marion. Find out more at mariancall.com. Or, of course, you can follow her on Twitter at Marion Call. That's MarianCall. Anomaly was created under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 Unported License. Say that three times fast.
World is much too interesting to entertain ennui, and I won't ever play it cool, so I won't ever once be bored. Oh, I have been a nerd since long before anyone heard that fair and scrawny was the latest fashion trend. And I still be a geek after nobody thinks it's chic, because I don't require approval.